It's my first time on this.
Yeah, they don't do slideshows.
I'll tell you what you can do, Doug, is, you could take some of your photos and swap them out for your profile picture. And, and if people pull the refresh, we could, your profile picture could be a little slideshow of, your photos of Steve.
I don't think I'm going to risk that tonight. It's too late here.
No, anymore. You don't want to do that.
Just want to say hi, John and Diane.
Hey, Doug.
Hi,
you doing?
Doug. How are you?
Sorry I missed you earlier. I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
We'll catch up after.
Yeah, we still have a lot of your photos, Doug.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, I've got your book here in front of me, Doug. It's called Fearless Genius. I'd recommend it highly to anyone interested in Steve. And just the images are incredible. Before I met you, I bought multiple copies of it, was sending it around, and one was to Daniel Lewin.
I remember.
And I think you were in his office when he opened it or something. It was like almost that ridiculous.
We just published in mainland China today. FYI. Great. Just heard that from Simon and Schuster.
Congratulations,
there's,
Doug.
There's Daniel. He looks a lot younger in that photo than I think in real life. But
that is my picture.
Fantastic. How many people are in the room now? It's hard to see from here.
Multitudes.
Hey, it's Mike Slade. I'm here. I'm just driving back to my house, so I'll keep it on mute.
Mike, welcome.
Yeah, thanks.
Mike was our first really good get. I was so impressed that he engaged and joined, and I did some research of the time he spent at Next and then Apple and Microsoft. Is just incredible. I can't wait to let him share some of his stories. So we've got Daniel, welcome. Daniel's one of three Computer History Museum board members here on the call today, and he's the CEO of the Computer History Museum and might have worked with Steve as long as anybody. So great to have you here, and welcome, Daniel.
Glad to be here.
Hi, Evelyn. Nice to see you.
I met Steve in April of 1977, so maybe that's longer than most.
How dominant was Apple back then?
How dominant? Well, they were renting the first 600 square feet outside of the garage next door to the office that I was working in.
Wow. Well, I think we're getting to the top of the hour, so I'm gonna kick it off if everybody's ready to go. And really, I'd ask speakers to put themselves on mute if you would until we call on you. That would be appreciated. And I want to thank my co-hosts Stephen Levy and Esther Dyson, who are legends in the tech world. And once they were attached to this crazy idea, everybody basically said yes, and or virtually everybody did. And we're here to share some Steve Jobs stories. He helped create an industry and left such an impact on the products we use and the people that are still in the business today. And it's his birthday tomorrow. He didn't make it to what would have been his 66th birthday, but given the impact he had, we thought it'd be a fun and great way to honor him and remember him just by telling some stories, particularly by people that really spent time with him and worked with him. And I think some of the biographies and stories, tend to have some of a negative slant to them. And I think there's a reason why people work with him again and again and over time and the impact they had. And I hope they share some stories you may not have heard before. At least they'll be their stories. We've got about anywhere between 14 and as many as 20 speakers that we've prearranged and lined up in advance. And we're going to go through it in kind of a chronological order, following, the early days at Apple into the first Mac launch into you know, the years at Next, and then kind of coming back through Pixar and the return to Apple. And we've got our speakers slotted in those various groups, and we're going to call on them to share some thoughts. And given that, you know, we have this room for 1 hour, we might go a little bit longer if there's demand, but we really don't, we really only have a couple minutes per story. So if I could ask everybody just try and keep it short and concise, that would get the most people to be able to hear the most stories. And if there's demand, we'll come back and do it again with another group, but let's try and keep it moving today. And tonight's show is being recorded, so just be aware of that. And with that, I'd like to kick it off, and I'd like to turn it over to Esther Dyson, who might tell a story of how she first met, and then she's going to introduce our first two speakers, Regis McKenna and John Scully. But Esther, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Okay, so hi, Regis. It turns out Regis.
Hi, Esther.
So nice to see you. Do you remember back in, like, it was 1988 or something, when 78. Something. Anyway, long before anybody here was born, Ben Rosen was having his conference that I later bought at the Playboy Resort, Lake Geneva, on Lake, what was it? The Lake Geneva Resort, something like that.
Yeah.
Playboy.
Yeah.
And you invited me and Steve to have drinks. Remember that?
Yep.
And who served us Diet Cokes?
Oh, God.
A Playboy Bunny.
I guess I should have remembered that. I'm getting too old.
Yeah, anyway, so that's how I met Regis. And later on, I think we're going to hear Regis now talk a little bit. And then I'm going to introduce John Scully with another little clever story. So go ahead, Regis.
Okay. You know, there's so many stories. I've been writing down notes for the last 3 days, and now I try to rewrite them, it just gets too long. So I'm just going to, I think Chris had asked me about how did we get started, and that came from a reference from Intel. Steve was very knowledgeable about the electronics industry in the Valley at the time. I mean, he would pick up the phone and call people, you know, at HP or wherever, and you know, he had no inhibitions about, you know, learning something from other people. And, you know, he called Intel and to ask them who was doing their work. And we were hired by Bob Noyce in 1971 and had been working for Intel for, this was probably when Steve came in, about 1976. So we had been working with Intel, and their big task, of course, was to try to figure out how to make the microprocessor successful. And because I had been with an MOS firm before that, a chip firm, I was in marketing, and then I was actually the third marketing guy at National. And so Bob Noyce and the people who I worked for at both those companies worked for Noyce. So Noyce was a great reference for me. When we met, it wasn't exactly the greatest of experiences for them. Steve came in. Wozniak had an article that he wanted published in Byte Magazine. The article was on the Apple II, which was not completed designed yet. And you know, I looked over the article and so forth, and they, you know, I basically made somewhat of the comment that, you know, this article is not going to do it for you. You're going to have to put something together that's much more, you know, long range and consistent and you know, really a real marketing effort. And Wozniak, and I said, I want to look at the article. And I looked at it, and it was, you know, engineer to engineer talk. And I had some experience in actually the hobby computer business. And I'll tell you about that in a second, but, you know, the Apple II, when it came out, was sort of a was a revolutionary product, because the products that were put onto the market before that, like the PET or the TRS or the MSI, they were basically, you know, metal boxes with switches and thumb switches on them, and quite frankly, you know, they didn't have a monitor, they didn't have an easy way to do things. They were built for engineers who were hobbyists, and not for what I thought this business should head into, is more the consumer market. And so I read Steve's article, and I told him that I thought it didn't fit, you know, it didn't really help them very much just by talking to other people like themselves, because they'd probably be very aware of the PC, you know, just because of their activities. And Wozniak got pissed and basically said, no, you know, I'm not going to let any marketing guy rewrite my stuff. And I basically said, hey, well, then there's nothing I can do for you, and showed them the door. So they left. And Steve called me back the next day. We went and met privately. We had a long, long couple of hours, 3 hours conversation. And it turned out that we got along really, really well. It wasn't that Steve and I didn't get along well. In fact, I knew Steve and I knew his mother and father quite well. They were neighbors. And so, you know, we got along, but it was just that Steve had this idea. So whenever they left and Steve came back, then things started to change drastically, and we started planning long term. I put together a marketing plan, which some of you know I've kept notebooks since 1970.
Regis, I just wanted to ask, is it true that you, like, how many pages of notes did you take when you first sat down?
With Steve?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Well, see, I have notebooks going back to 1970 and all my clients. So I would, it was sort of a running dialogue. There wasn't, I probably have to go back and count it, but I had something like 150 to 200 notebooks. And they are scanned now, and they're at Stanford Library. Steve and I just started meeting. Well, I didn't have to actually ask him. He would stop at my house. He came over on his Harley. And we chatted about what we were going to do and where it was going to go. I think one of the big advantages was when Mike Markla came in. Mike basically wanted to put up a fairly sizable marketing budget. And I was kind of afraid of that, because, this was a startup, and we know what happens to startups who spend a lot of money. And I also worked for Don Valentine, so I knew at one point in my life, so I knew the discipline of trying to maintain your budgets. But Mike was insistent, and I think that almost doubled everything that we did in a shorter period of time. And I think that really launched the Apple II into a really successful marketplace. So much so, by the way, and Steve sort of took ownership of that. He was the one who really went out and evangelized the Apple II. In Time Magazine, they did an article on Apple and Steve in about 1985, and in it, they said Steve Jobs may well have been single-handedly been the person who started the whole personal computer industry.
That's fantastic. So, hey, Regis, yeah. I really appreciate the stories, and we just are just short on time to get into all of them, and or even a couple of them. But I'll tell everybody that we've captured your oral history at the Computer History Museum and have everything there, which is fantastic. But maybe this would be a good time to transition, talk about the Apple II, and, you know, maybe for Esther to introduce our next speaker.
Okay. Whatever you want to do.
Thank you, Regis, very much.
Okay, well, why don't I introduce John? I have a few more stories for later on, but John, this, you may not remember this, it's a fond story. You had just, taken over, and you invited a bunch of reporters and analysts to come have lunch with you in some conference room, and it was, you know, typical Apple conference room with tofu and bean sprouts and various things arranged in this lovely buffet. And we talked for a while, and then it was time for lunch. And you reached into your briefcase and pulled out a big PB&J. And I'll always remember that. It was sort of like from Diet Cokes with Regis to PB&J and Pepsi with John. And frankly, you took, you know, you helped make it into a business. But the contrast was pretty startling. And I'm sure you experienced this whole thing very differently. It would be interesting to hear your take on that. I remember you also coming to PC Forum with Steve, and people were kind of annoyed because you and Steve kept talking to one another instead of talking to all these people who wanted to talk to you.
Yeah, well those are good memories, and I remember all those things, Esther. Just to give you some context, you know, back on the East Coast, when I told my friends that I was going to Apple, they didn't know what Apple was. And then I explained it was in Silicon Valley, and they called it Silicon Valley, and they weren't sure they'd ever heard of it before. So it was really, if you were in Silicon Valley, of course you knew, you know, Apple and all the things that were going on. But if you were in the East Coast, and particularly in corporate America, where I was at the time, it was like it didn't exist. And so I was first recruited to come out and meet Steve. And the background of that was that Steve had really wanted to become the CEO of Apple. And he was about 26 years old, I think, at the time. And the board had said, Steve, you're not ready to be a CEO, but you're chairman of the board, so we'll give you veto rights over who we bring in. And they went through all of the, you know, logical, qualified, you know, people in the tech industry, particularly in Silicon Valley, and Steve turned every one of them down. So David Rockefeller from the Rockefeller family, Ven Rock, was one of the very early investors in Apple, said, why don't you try a different industry in a different part of the country? And so that's how my name surfaced. Well, one of the early trips I made to Silicon Valley was to come to the Macintosh building. I might say at the headquarters at that time was on Banley Drive, and it was a residential building. Regis, you probably remember that. And the Mac building was Banley 2, and it was a one-story tilt-up concrete wall building with a pirate flag flying from the roof. And Steve brought me into the building. He didn't want anyone to know, because the Mac was a stealth project at that time, that he was bringing someone in from the outside. So the basic story he had told the Mac group was that John Sculley was the CEO of Pepsi, and he was interested in being one of the first customers to buy Pepsi, Apple computers with the new Mac when it came out. And I remember at that time, Andy Hertzfeld, Andy, you might remember this, had put together a demo of dancing Pepsi cans on a prototype Mac. This was still when it was not even in its case, I don't think, at that time. It was like a benchtop, you know, display and a bunch of, you know, wires going to motherboards and power supplies and so forth. So I'm watching this animation that Andy had put together. And it was pretty cool because it was dancing Pepsi cans, but I had no idea, because I didn't have a background in computers, how sophisticated the demo was that Andy had put together of dancing Pepsi cans. I didn't realize that computer animation on a screen like that was really revolutionary at the time. Steve and I spent 4 months getting to know each other. I either came out to California and met with him, or he would come back to the East Coast. And I remember, I think it was the last week of March 1983, and we had spent the day together. It was a Sunday. I had taken Steve over to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I took him to something that I had a pretty good idea he'd never had seen before or knew much about, and that was showing him archaic art and archaistic sculptures and Praxiteles curves with various sculptures from the 4th, 5th, and 6th century BC in Greece, and took him through the sea silexes and amphoras, which are the painted vases that they made back in those times. And then Steve took me to Tower Records to listen to some of his favorite music. And finally, we ended up on the terrace of a new penthouse that Steve had bought over on the west side at the San Remo Tower. He later sold this three-story penthouse to Bono, but back in those days, Steve thought he wanted to have a residence in New York City in addition to being in Silicon Valley. And as we're standing there looking out over the East River, as the sun was going down, I said, "Steve, I've thought about it, but we've spent 4 months getting to know each other. You know, I really love our relationship, but I'm not coming to Apple." I said, "I'll be, an advisor for free, but I think I'm going to stay here on the East Coast." And there was this long silence and a pause. And in those days, Steve had jet black hair. He had very black eyes. And he wore his classic black turtleneck sweater and blue jeans. And he gets about 18 inches from my face, and he stares at me for a few seconds. And then he says, "Do you want to sell sugared water for the rest of your life, or do you want to come with me and change the world?" And that is so classic Steve Jobs, because Steve was not only incredibly charismatic, as we all know, but he had this gift to be able to put words together in a way that was so appropriate for whatever the moment was he had to do it. He just was, an intuitive person, an intuitive leader. And he was just one of those people who could, he was as much into the arts and the humanities as he was into technology, as all of us who worked with him know. He wasn't actually trained as an engineer, but he had a great sense of design. And he had a great sense of that he was going to build computers that were going to change the world, because they were going to be for non-technical people to do creative things. And throughout all the time that I worked with Steve, it was always that tension between, the most advanced technology that he could bring to solve a problem for non-technical people to have this amazing, as he called it, insanely great tools, the first Mac. But it was also always about the humanity and the creative things that these non-technical people would do.
John, thank you so much. That's an incredible story. And I'll also share that we either have or will soon be collecting your oral history for the Computer History Museum. And we did a Zoom last summer that at some point we'll share. So I really appreciate you being here, and look forward to letting everybody get to enjoy those as well. I want to turn things over next to Stephen Levy, but I also heard a rumor that Woz is in the room. And if that's true, I would love to invite Steve Wozniak to raise your hand. I'm going to open up the hand raising ability. And if you're there and want to come up on stage, would love to have you. If not, and you're here, enjoy the stories, but would love to hear yours as well, Woz.
That would be great.
Let me turn it over to Stephen right now, please.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Keep an eye out for Woz if he's there. So I met Steve, I remember, the exact month, I'll probably find the date, in late 1983. The preface was, I have been starting to write about technology for the last year or so, and I was contributing at a Rolling Stone, and I told my editors, there's something happening out here, and the Apple computer, this company is going to do this new computer, and it really actually would interest our audience. I really pushed to talk them into doing this story, and they finally gave me the assignment, and I thought, this is going to be fantastic. Apple's going to be so excited, and I approached Andy Cunningham and thought that, this is going to be a cinch, And, you know, Andy, I don't know if you remember this, but, you know, you didn't like jump up for joy or anything. And then you got back to me and said, well, there's an issue. And the issue was that Steve said that he'd only do it if it would be on the cover of Rolling Stone. And, you know, that wasn't going to happen. At that point, no one had been on the cover of Rolling Stone except, you know, rock stars and movie stars. And Steve, actually, I found out, maybe Andy could verify this, called up Jan Wenner and told him that he was making a big mistake by not putting him on the cover.
Yes, he did. That's right, Stephen. That is exactly what he did.
Yeah, but finally, I guess that they figured, well, Rolling Stone, maybe people like Andy said, Steve, this is our chance to be in Rolling Stone. And they said, okay. And I remember it day that changed my life is when I went to Banley 3, maybe, the building was then. And I not only saw this computer that, you know, I would be using and still use like a Macintosh, but I met this amazing group of people. I've never had a day in journalism like that in my entire life where I met a group of people, and this is, you know, almost like 40 years ago, who became my friends. To this day, they're my friends, and, you know, kind of, and, you know, like a friend is someone you're in town, you call up, you have dinner with, you might go to a concert or something like that, and Andy and Susan Kerr and Joanna Hoffman, these are people who, you know, we've seen our kids grow up and all kinds of stuff through the years. So I met these amazing people who just blew me away. And at the end of the day, I was going to have dinner with Steve Jobs. And I had never met him. And he came out and, you know, he was still a little piqued that he wasn't going to be the cover of Rolling Stone, told me that Jan's making a big mistake. And then he proceeded to tell me what his critique of Rolling Stone, and he had read this story on the plane, of this big story about MTV, and it was the biggest piece of shit he'd ever read, and he kept going on and on, and I just waited for a break in his conversation to tell him that I wrote that story. And when I finally got that out, you know, and this is pure Steve, he just like registered that and just changed the subject. That was it. Just went on to something else. And, you know, we went off to have pizza at dinner and did this amazing interview about the Macintosh. And I wrote the story and the picture of the story. This is like a weird, you know, development. Wound up years later on the cover of Rolling Stone after he died. So that's a weird circle there. Anyway. Wow. Since I brought Andy into it, you know, you were working then, repping the Mac. What's your Steve Jobs tale?
No, Stephen, I remember every moment of all of that. And the photo shoot was done with a photographer named Norman Seif. And I have the original set of photos also. Anyway, I'll just tell a very quick story because we brought in 100 journalists to Banley 3, to the Mac building. But at the towards the end in January, right before January 24th, 1984, when we actually launched this thing, we went into New York to do the final business press stuff, Fortune, Forbes, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, all that. And John, you might remember that you like to stay at the Helmsley Palace, and my friend Jane Anderson, who did a lot of this work with me, she stayed with you there, and Steve liked to stay at the Carlisle Hotel, and I stayed with Steve there. And we got in around 10 o'clock one night, and he had to rearrange all the furniture, and he had to have a baby grand delivered, and he had to have special calla lilies all over the place, and strawberries and cream, and there was all these fixings that had to happen to the room. And he and I basically did this pretty much the two of us together. We ended up going to bed, sleeping. The next morning we wake up and we're starting to see the business press. So Fortune comes in, and Steve hated having his picture taken, absolutely couldn't stand it. And he could sometimes become a big baby when that was going on. And for some reason I brought with me one of those old cassette tape recorders with the tape Thriller on it from Michael Jackson. I knew he loved Michael Jackson. And so I just sort of put it on softly in the background, and the Billie Jean song came on, and he became like a happy child when that song was on, and he would comply with the editors or the journalists' requests. He would pose for the pictures, and then the song would end, and he would become, agitated and ornery again and mean and nasty and refused to do whatever the photographer asked him to do. So I'd rewind, and then put it back on. And then he'd be calm and peaceful and a lovely person. And then the same thing happened again. It happened like three times over the course of doing those photos. So if anybody looks at those photos that were taken for the Mac launch, they're all over the place. They're in a lot of the publications from back then. You'll see snarls on Steve's face in many of them, and a couple of them he's smiling, and that was when Billie Jean was playing. So anyway, that's my Steve Jobs story for tonight.
Well, thank you, Andy. And now we've got a couple of some of the Mac people who I met that day, Andy Hertzfeld and Bill Atkinson, these two people who just blew me away. They were their enthusiasm and excitement, and they started, you know, just showing me this and that and the thing. Andy, you know, let me pull you in first, and probably no one's got like more fascinating stories than you. I know you put a lot of them in a great book, about Mac folklore. And but why don't you share something with us now?
Yeah, I want to tell a story that's not in my book about the very first time I went to a restaurant with Steve. About was working on the Mac project probably for about a week. It was really the first time I socialized with Steve. He used to come in toward the end of the day. Most of the time he'd spend outside the Mac building, on corporate stuff. But around 6 p.m. or so, he used to come by. He invited me and Burl Smith, the hardware designer, out to dinner. And we walked just about a 5-minute walk to Florentine's, a sort of mid-level Italian restaurant. I ordered veal parmesan and was shocked when he went into a tirade about how it would be killing me and don't I know that mucus is bad for me. He started quoting scientific evidence that meat is murder. Something about the shape of the esophagus. Then he went on talking about fasting. He was real enthusiastic about fasts and explained how fasting isn't just stopping food. There were dozens of different ways to fast. But what I remember him saying more than anything else was, if you don't know the right way to break a fast, it could be dangerous. You could eat a pea and your stomach would explode. Anyway, the meal progressed, and it finally came time to pay for the meal. We didn't really know each other all that well then, but I did know that Apple had just gone public a month before, and Steve was worth something like $300 million. And so we kind of eyed each other when it came time to pay, and Steve spoke up and said, "I don't have a wallet." And so I said, "Well, I just have a credit card." And Steve said, "Use it." And that's my story. The first time I went to lunch with Steve, dinner actually. I could tell more, but I know time's.
That's probably a good investment to buy that meal, Andy.
Yeah.
No. We might circle back, but Bill, I know you worked. You actually were the Xerox Park, famous Xerox Park excursion. But let me leave it to you. What stories you want to tell with Steve?
I know we're short on time, so I'll just tell one story, and that's about how Steve recruited me. I was up in University of Washington, Seattle, studying neuroscience, and I got a call from my friend Jeff Raskin that I knew from undergraduate college, and he said, "Oh, this really cool thing is starting up here. You got to come and be part of it." And I said, "No, I'm busy with my work, my studies." But he didn't take no for an answer and sent me round trip airfare. So I figured, what the heck? I came down. Well, I don't know what Jeff said to Steve, but Steve took me around and spent his entire day introducing me to all 30 people at Apple. This was April 1978. And each person seemed to be having fun. They were working. There seemed like they had a good attitude. They thought they were doing something good in the world. But at the end of the day, I said, "You know, I really have to finish my studies. If I don't get the PhD, I won't get to do research on consciousness and brains." And he said, and took me aside, and he said, "Well, any hot new technology you read about is actually 2 years old.
there's a lag time between when something's invented and when it's available to the public. If you want to make a difference in the world, you have to be ahead of that lag time. Come to Apple, where you can invent the future and change millions of people's lives. That kind of made it dent on me. But then he closed the deal by, he gave me a visual. And he used his hands to gesture. And he said, think how fun it is to surf on the front edge of a wave. And he's sort of making a surfing movement with his hand. And then he said, and how not fun to dog paddle on the tail end of the same wave. That visual image just kind of stuck in my mind. And less than 2 weeks later, I had moved from Seattle. I'd quit my neuroscience program. I'd moved from Seattle, and I was working at Apple Computer. And that's an example of how persuasive Steve can be. And I'm so glad that he was, because I had an amazing and wonderful time at Apple. And I'm still interested in consciousness, but I don't at all regret the 12 years I spent at Apple.
Well, yeah, and I've been a little remiss for those, because I assume everyone would know who Bill and Andy are. But you know, Bill was integral, engineer, did a lot of the work for Lisa, and then did famously Mac Paint. Later, HyperCard was his invention, which was really the precursor of the World Wide Web. Andy was one of the key people in the Mac OS, and a lot of people consider him the spirit of Apple, to carry it through, and to carry Woz's torch into the Macintosh and beyond. So these are really, just like iconic, let's say, people in Apple's history, and particularly in that of the Mac. I want to bring in Daniel Lewin, another person on the Mac team. Daniel, earlier you were talking about you met Steve super early.
Yeah, in April of 1977, I took a job working for Sony, and which is where the 3.5-inch floppy eventually came from to Apple. But Steve and four or five others moved into 600 square feet next door to my office the same week that I started, and he wandered into the office because it had Sony written on the door and was feeling the paper and the quality of the collateral and things of that ilk. So we developed a conversational rapport at that time. And then I went to work at Apple when the 3.5-inch floppy came out, which was December of 80. And then was part of the team. I was there when John came into the room when Steve was recruiting John to become the CEO, and Andy's demo and Susan's beautiful pictures. So I was the person who ran around the country with the Mac for a couple of years before it was announced, and organized the university community, sort of the next generation of people to buy into the lifestyle associated with Apple and Apple marketing. So the consortia activity. And then when Steve was leaving for various reasons, he recruited me to come and be a founder at Next. I thought the story that I would tell, because I know everyone has lots of stories that they like to tell, there's a fun one. People may or may not know there was a moment in time in Next history when Canon invested. I give you this story because I was party to bringing the floppy disk in, the 3.5-inch floppy disk into the Mac, not from an engineering perspective, but from a relationship perspective. And Canon made an investment in the company. We had a very good relationship with them as a result of the LaserWriter and the work that had been done originally at Apple. And the chairman was present when we finalized the deal, and it was a question as to whether they were going to invest $50 million or $100 million into the company. This is in 1986 or so, when that was a lot of money. And the question was asked of Steve, how much money do you need to succeed? Because he put 50 or 100 on the table. And he said 100. And they asked, well, what will we get that's different if we give you 100 versus 50? And he said, a board seat. So they took the board seat, and we were having dinner that night at Steve's house to celebrate. And there was a table in the dining room, which was one of the few pieces of furniture in the house. And I believe it was a table that Shakespeare had penned a number of his works on in England. It's quite an old table. The chairs were also quite old and I would say flimsy. And at one moment in the dinner, the chairman of Canon fell flat on his ass when the chair collapsed. And there was a sort of a deadly silence for a moment. This was Japanese protocol, particularly in the 1980s. And they all smiled, and the chairman got up from the floor and said, "At least we now know what to get Mr. Jobs for Christmas."
That's fantastic.
I have hundreds of stories like that.
Thanks.
I should also mention that Chris has mentioned the Computer History Museum a number of times. Daniel is the CEO of the Computer History Museum.
I was going to tell a story about Lotus Notes, which nearly was produced originally on the next machine, because we're going to be celebrating Ray Ozzie at the Computer History Museum in the latter part of March. Everyone's welcome to sign up as part of the fellows program. And I'm really happy to be there. And as people have pointed out, there are dozens and dozens of stories that are all archived there. There's 1,000 oral histories among many.
Including Daniel's. So you could get all of that. And thank you very much, Daniel. And I think that's probably, just from a timing perspective, a good transition, as Daniel was, at Apple and then left to help start Next with Steve. And I want to invite our next speaker up, who's Doug Menuet, who was a photojournalist working with Steve at Next and then many other Silicon Valley companies. And maybe you could share some of your fly in the wall story or two.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Thank you. It's such an honor to be here with so many of the people that I just look at as legends and inspirations. But I came to Steve via Rick Smolin, who I hadn't been convinced yet, and I wasn't in love yet. I hadn't been seduced by Silicon Valley, even though I'd been to Apple shooting as a photojournalist in 82. And then in 83, I first met John Sculley doing his portrait for Time or USA Today. But in 85, I had come back from covering the famine and conflict in Eritrea and Ethiopia. And I was pretty devastated, looking for something more positive to cover. And Rick said to me, "Did you know that Steve was forced out at Apple and is now starting a new company?" And I wasn't that intrigued until I heard it was going to be a supercomputer for education. And I knew, as a photojournalist, that was the source of every social issue that I was interested in. So I thought, oh my God, if Steve Jobs has already changed the world with the Mac, which I did buy one in December of 84, I had a Mac. If he's done that, then maybe education has hope. We could go there. So, and then later, he introduced me to Dana Lewin and Susan Kare. And I then found out that my idea to document him for Life magazine, with his team building the next computer from inception to shipping, to understand the process of innovation for Life magazine. Well, that was a great idea, but Steve already had the idea to document what he was doing. And I think they had a video team in there. Anyway, I proposed documenting from inception to shipping, and they accepted the idea, and Steve was like, "Well, you better get busy." And he trusted me and brought me up and convinced people to let me do what I do. Because if you could imagine how secretive things are today, it was just as secretive then. To have a photographer roaming the halls, shooting over your shoulder, source code on the screen. Anyway, he was really kind and very patient with me. And I did observe what Andy alluded to, his treatment of some other photographers coming in. I was on this long-term thing, so people got used to me, and I became invisible, I think. I also stayed out of his sightline as much as I could. But we often would have conversations, and he would show me things and teach me things. He's very generous that way. Anyway, as Regis mentioned about history, Steve knew whose shoulders he stood on. One of the things I loved about him was his love of history. And he would call up people, anybody, pick their brains, and come back to the office and then gather people around and share like different issues and things about technology cycles that were happening. And then so the years went by, and I documented this story, over the years, and I thought we had a good relationship. But there was a thing about Steve is that he had to be on your game. He wanted the best and the brightest. And I knew that someday he would turn to me and challenge me. Even though everything had been going great, I had never been challenged. And it forced me to kind of come to terms with who I was and what I was doing. And I think that was one of the best things Steve did for people, was force you to realize what your purpose was and what you were doing. And I'd been willing to die to take a picture that would change the world, but that hadn't happened yet. But I realized all I had to do was take pictures of these people and show up, and that was my purpose. So that became a lot easier for me to work with Steve. And then one day, and this is the story, and Andy will probably appreciate this, because I was sent down to shoot Steve for the cover of Fortune. And this was, I think, in 89. So I kind of was winding down my project, or had finished. And Steve comes in about 2 hours late, and he had hired I.M. Pei to design this staircase. It was the first prototype. It was cement, not glass, but it was just like the store would be. And I thought, oh, this is the perfect graphic design background. It's beautiful. And everyone agreed. I set up the lights. Everything was ready to go for this cover shoot. Steve was really late. He was coming down from Pixar. And he came in, and you could see he was sweating. He was mad. He'd been in traffic. And he looked at the setup, and he said, this is the stupidest idea I've ever seen. He came over, like John said, 18 inches, maybe 10 inches from my face, and repeated it. This is the stupid. I'm not going to say the swear words, because I think this is a new app and they're probably sensitive to community standards. But anyway, he was cursing like mad right in my face. Now, I had been kidnapped at gunpoint by rebels in Sudan. I was covering the drug wars in East Oakland. I'd been in a few very life-threatening situations. This was the most terrifying thing that ever happened to me. I felt like I was 10 years old. But I had learned from watching Steve with his engineers over the years, the key to Steve was trust. He had to know that you were willing to die for your ideas, whatever you were suggesting, or he wouldn't believe in it. If he didn't like it, you really had to stand up for your idea and go all the way to the mat with him. So I took a deep breath and I just said, no, Steve, it's a good idea. This is stupid. No, Steve, I think it's great. No, this is horrible. I hate this idea. But Steve, I've already shot six covers of Fortune. Trust me. And he gets so mad, he stops talking and he walks away from me. And then he swings around, he points right in my face and he says, you just want to sell magazines. I knew I had him, because I said, well, and you just want to sell computers, right? And he threw his head back and he burst out laughing and he said, where do you want me? And it was the best-selling cover of Fortune that year. And that's my story.
Thank you, Doug. That's a great story, well told, and I highly recommend the book Fearless Genius. You'll love it.
Thank you.
That's a great opportunity to shift into, coming out of Next, and ultimately ending up back at Apple. And at this point, I'd like to bring Mike Slade. He's on the stage, but ask him to speak a little bit. And Mike is a name I've known a little bit over the years, but when you dig into what he did, and maybe Mike, that's a good place just to explain your background and what you uniquely did at Microsoft Next, and then really uniquely at Apple, and then tell your story, please.
Hi. Yeah, thanks. It's really fun to be on this evening. And Steve was a dear friend of mine. And when he died, it was the saddest thing I can think of, and I loved him to death. So I went to Stanford Business School. I worked at Microsoft. I introduced Excel for the Mac. We had a press conference at Tavern on the Green in 1985 that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were at. And I then sort of was in charge of all the Mac products at Microsoft for a long time. And then Steve wooed me away to come be the VP of marketing at Next Computer. And I left, $50 million on the table, but I got seduced by Steve. And I worked for him for a couple of years, helped reposition Next to be focused on selling kind of its app development capabilities to large companies that were using it to develop mission critical apps. It actually worked. And then I left and went and ran a startup for Paul Allen called Starwave that built ESPN.com. We sold it to Disney. And then after I sold it, I came back and worked for Steve halftime at Apple for 6 years from 98 to 04 as kind of an executive consigliere. I was a part of the executive team. I came down there every Monday and Tuesday and was kind of a minister without portfolio. So he could ask me what I thought of something and I had no turf to protect, which was great. And it was really fun. Anyway, so all that sort of some how I got close to him. But the story I want to tell, both Daniel and John Scully told great stories about how Steve wooed them, and Steve wooed me for a long time. I was working at Microsoft. I liked living in the Northwest. I was making a lot of stock options, and so Steve and I had this long, complicated courtship and a bunch of dinners in Palo Alto. I went rollerblading around downtown Palo Alto with his new wife, his then girlfriend, Laureen. They almost killed me rollerblading. We watched old movies together. I spent the night at his house a couple times. And finally, I was not going to come, just like, in fact, I turned him down once. And then he basically said to me, you know, you're going to rot in Seattle. There's nothing going on up there. And he said, you know, if you lived in Palo Alto, and I'd gone to Stanford Business School, so I'd lived there before and I liked it. He said, you know, you can walk around downtown Palo Alto and it's like, I don't know, it's like being in Florence in the Renaissance. You can meet a scholar, an astronomer, a biotech scientist, an engineer. He went on and he laid it on so thick. And sure enough, you know, I mean, I love Steve because we were both marketers. He laid it on so thick that I came and I uprooted my wife from Seattle. We had to find her a new barn for her goddamn horses. We had to do all this stuff. And so finally, we get to Menlo Park and I start working at Next. And it's super fun and super challenging. And I was kind of a bigger fish in a smaller pond, which was really what I wanted. And I worked really closely with Steve. So we've been there like a month and we decided to go to Il Fornaio in downtown Palo Alto, which many of you know is sort of the default cool restaurant in downtown Palo Alto, right below the Garden Court Hotel. So we go there and we're sitting there and I'm going to have like in a salad and some pasta and a Moretti. And it's a really nice night. And I looked at the menu and I look at the back of the menu. And now, granted, Il Fornaio is a great restaurant, but it is a chain restaurant. Okay. There's more than one. I look at the back of the menu and in big, beautiful Italian type, it says, Palo Alto is like Florence in the Renaissance. You can walk down the street and meet an astronomer, a scholar, and the guy, okay, we're talking about Steve Jobs, who created the world's most valuable company, one of the coolest people I've ever had the privilege of hanging out with. He just cribbed it shamelessly. He just totally stole it from a menu, okay? And I look at my wife and I just kind of go, I don't believe it. You know, we got snookered. So
but you know, he also stole the chef from Il Fornaio too.
No, I know. They put the big pizza oven in it at Infinite Loop and it was great. But the funny part is that one of the things that I loved about Steve was that the end justified the means, right? It was like whatever it takes to get stuff done, you know, don't forget that, you know, all entrepreneurs are very opportunistic and very creative, and whatever works, it doesn't really matter. And so I have 1,000 stories to tell, but this is the one that in its own way, it kind of endeared him to me the most, because I was like, oh, even though he's a genius and even though he's the coolest person I've ever met, he's still a bullshitter just like me.
Well, I want to tee up actually, Mike, maybe one more story. First, I want to tell a story, you know, after I went to Newsweek, not long after I started working there, Steve returned to Apple and, you know, sort of glommed on me as one of the, you know, go-to places to show new products and, you know, and talk. And, you know, so I spent a lot of time, you know, visiting him and, you know, going to Infinite Loop. And at one time, I had an idea to do the iPod as a cover for Newsweek, as a cultural item. It was a few years after it came out, it sort of broke through in the culture. And it was a rare time where Apple agreed to do a story, even though they weren't coming out with like a new product. So, you know, and I did a long interview with Steve just about the iPod and, you know, and how it developed. And I pulled out my iPod, and at the time I was like actually recording the interview on an iPod. I had a little microphone that I put on there, but I had to take off this little case I had, and Steve looked at this and he was just appalled that I had some sort of cover for you know the iPod. He said, like, you know, how could you possibly do that? It's meant to be, you know, just like exposed, you know. And I said, well, you know, if it can get like scuffed up. And he said, listen, you know, we're both getting a little old here, and like, yeah, you know, it's kind of cool to get, you know, scuffed up like a pair of jeans. and the thing was, I didn't realize till years later that when he said that was just about a month after he had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And so that thing of saying we're both getting scuffed up had a little extra resonance to me. And Mike, I know you once told me a story about how you learned about him being sick.
Yeah, well, so when I went back to work at Apple, Steve had this app. Finally, he took the corner office in the building, the executive building, which was a big, beautiful office. And right next to him was his admin, who at the time was a woman named Andrea Nordeman. And then next to her was this little window office that was me. And so even though I was only there 2 days a week, that was my office. And so I was like, you know, 6 feet from Steve. And, you know, I'd be walk by each other going to the bathroom. We got lunch together. We basically spent 2 days together every week. So I actually have two stories. He only came into my office twice because his office was so cool. So I'll tell both stories, and then I'll let us get on. The first story, he comes to my office one time, and he goes, Mike, I need your advice. And I'm like, okay, big strategy. Okay, this is exciting. So I'm getting the big bucks for it. And he goes, I'm having a big argument with Lorene. And I go, uh-oh. And I go, about what? And he goes, well, it's about cheese. And I'm like, cheese? And he goes, yeah, I don't think my kids should eat cheese. Remember, they had little kids at the time. This is like 2002 or something. And I go, well, why not? And he goes, because cheese is bad, milk, dairy. And it goes on and on and on. And he goes, but Lorene thinks they should have cheese as a source of protein, even though she's a vegetarian. And I go, I just look at him and I go, you know, I don't think winning this argument is good. I think you want to lose this argument. Why would you want to win this argument? So then about a year later, he comes in my office on a Monday and he shuts the door and he starts crying. And he says, I've got pancreatic cancer. I'm going to die in a few months. And I'm freaking out. And I just looked at him and I started crying. And we hugged and we were both just completely freaked out. And he's like, don't tell anyone. And then the next day, Tuesday, because I was always there Monday and Tuesdays, he comes back in my office and he says, I don't have pancreatic cancer. I have an islet cell tumor. It's rare but treatable. And both of us were just kind of looking at each other like, I can't believe we had this interaction 2 days in a row. Like, this is the strangest thing of all. And I just have never, I think, ever experienced a range of emotions like that in a 2 day period. So both were emotional. And then, of course, as we all know, he probably should have treated it differently than he did. It's super tragic what happened. But that happened. He called the whole executive team together and told them what happened. Which was also rather moving. You know, one of the things you were talking about the iPod is that the iPod was announced a month after 9/11. So, you know, I was at Apple the day at 9/11. No one knew what was going to happen. Steve said, I'm not believing to be in business. He looked at me and he goes, there's going to be a war. That's what he said. He goes, there's going to be a war. And then a month later, we had the iPod announcement just in this little theater at Apple. I bet you, Stephen, you were there. There were probably 100 people there, maybe 200 people tops. Like, wasn't it very
big deal? No, no. Actually, because I was at Newsweek, you know, we were 9/11. I didn't go out to that, you know, Steve.
You didn't go. Yeah, so it wasn't well attended. Yeah,
but Steve, right. Steve called me. They delivered the thing to me.
Steve, weren't you the first one to show the Apple iPod to Bill Gates?
That's right.
And yeah, what did he say?
That night, they were releasing, Sinofsky would know this, he's in the audience, I think. You know.
Oh, that's right.
They were releasing the new version of the new OS for Windows. And there was the first event they did in New York City.
Oh, it was Vista. There.
And they had a dinner the night before, and I was sitting next to Gates, and I had just gotten the new iPod, which had been, you know, like announced that day. You know, like Steve wouldn't even trust Federal Express. They had couriers, big bodyguards come up to my office at Newsweek and drop it off. And, you know, and I showed it to this guy. I said, have you seen this? I had it in my jacket pocket. And I pulled out the iPod, which he's heard about. And Gates said, no. And, you know, let me see it. And, you know, he took it. And I watched him, he like, you know, spin the dial and looking at all the menus and going through it and listening. And it was like almost like an alien had the power to kind of suck up all the information from a device. And, you know, and he's going through it. And finally, he gives it back and he says, this is for Macintosh only? So
that's the key question. That's the key question.
Anyway, so we got a few more to go. So.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, so much.
Sure, my pleasure.
So I'm going to tell two very brief stories about Steve in order to model it. Then I'm going to introduce Tim Baharin. So these both were at PC Forum. The first one, speaking of death, whatever, he was supposed to be on a panel that, because he was on the panel, Paul Moritz had refused to sit on that same panel. And then the day before the panel, I get this message, I need to call Steve back. And of course, this was still in the day of payphones. So I call Steve back and he tells me his dad is dying. He's really, really sorry, but he can't make it. And, you know, will I possibly forgive him and so forth and so on. And I say, look, Steve, it's your dad. Of course I'll forgive you. And he said, yes, but Esther, I'll make it up to you. Next year I'll come and I'll speak twice. And that was vintage Steve Jobs. The other was he had come and he had spoken at PC Forum. And as you can tell, he was an amazing person. But he also, he was a tough competitor. You know, the Bill Gates, Steve, whatever. There were a lot of people there who kind of grudgingly admired him, but they were competing with him, and, you know, it wasn't always friendly. But he had to leave in order to be on Larry King Live. And sort of the cream of the industry gathered, I think it was Ben Rosen's room or my room or something like that, to watch him on TV. And suddenly the vibe changed, because of all the people in the industry, he was the only one you'd want to put on with Larry King Live to explain computers to the great American public. He was our spokesman. He was explaining us to all these people who still thought we were, you know, like what John Sculley said, nobody out in the East Coast even knew who Apple was. And he was indeed the voice and the image of the industry. And a huge loss. So let me introduce Tim Baharin, please.
Thank you, Esther. I'm actually an industry analyst, and for some bizarre reason, I was one of the only industry analysts that Steve would actually talk to. It was the time when he went to Next when we had a little shaky relationship. But if I said something that he didn't like, he would call. And when he decided to come back to Apple, I was asked to come and meet with him the second day he came back. And Apple at that time was already $1 billion in the red. We now know that they were probably 6 or 7, 8 weeks out from possibly being bankrupt. And I looked at Steve and I said, hey, how in the world are you going to save Apple? What are you going to do that's going to pull them out of this hole? And he looked at me and he said, look, my predecessors really did not take care of my customers, Apple's customers. And he said, my real core customers are the engineers, the creative types, etc. And if you know Apple's history from the time Spindler came in and Emilio came in, Apple actually even tried to do a clone. I mean, they just really changed what the Mac was, and it was completely different than what Steve's original vision was. And so he said, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go back and build the technology that will meet the needs of those particular customers. And then he, on kind of an aside, he said something very different. And it was one of those statements to me that at the time just was curious, and I didn't actually understand. But he said, I'm also going to focus on industrial design. And I, again, this was 1997. And at that point, I remember walking away from that meeting with him and just saying to myself, how in the world is industrial design going to save Apple? Well, historically, we now know he created the candy-colored iMacs, and that helped actually pull Apple out of the red and to get them goats, because he sold millions of those. Not long after that, he brought the iPod, which of course was an ideal device that had all kind of industrial design to it. And then in 2007, he brought the iPhone, which was an industrial design marvel. And so over the years, I thought back to that particular meeting many times, because it really represented the way Steve was so visionary. I always knew he had a good gut feel, but boy, when he told me that he was going to focus on industrial design, I have to admit, I walked out of there scratching my head.
He sure did. Tim, thank you so much for sharing, and great to have you on Clubhouse and in this room. We're at the 10 o'clock mark in the East Coast, but we're going to keep going because there's still some more stories, but we're not going to go on all night. So we'll get several more, but really appreciate having everybody here. And I see so many interesting people in the audience that I want to cold call on people. Like Michael Dell was in the room and I cold called him and he chose not to come up. But I just saw Troy Carter come in. I would love to ask him maybe if he was interested. But what I want to do now is that invite Steven Rosenblatt, who I mentioned. He earlier worked for a company called Quattro Wireless that Apple acquired, and he was responsible for helping sell the first Apple ads. And he told me a story that kind of got me thinking about how many other great stories are out there and not really known. So, Steven, I appreciate if you'd share that one, please.
Yeah. So maybe I'll set it up. So it's November 2009, financial crisis. Google had just bought a company called AdMob. Mobile ads are, you know, just becoming this thing, you know, that ads on a mobile device. And Apple and Steve is paranoid that the developers, you know, just launched the App Store, is pretty much in its infancy, knew that was the key to selling, you know, iPhones. And Steve was paranoid that Google, which really was at the time the, you know, the only 800-pound gorilla that was out there, that was monetizing on mobile, he was scared that Google was going to rip all the ads out of iOS and the iPhone, and the developers follow the money, because there's only two ways developers make money: ads and subscription, especially at that time, and still pretty much to this day. So anyway, you know, Google buys AdMob, we're the next one at the beauty pageant that they were looking at, and so Steve had met with our team. He was excited about acquiring, you know, looking at acquiring us. You know, Apple at that time only acquired like five companies. I think there was the biggest acquisition back before us was at that time was a semiconductor company. So I'll never forget, he wants to meet me before he makes the official acquisition. I was the head of revenue. I was the head of monetization. I fly out there with our CEO and co-founder, Andy Miller, to Cupertino. And I'm 33 years old, and I'm freaking out that I'm about to spend time with Steve Jobs. And this meeting may break our acquisition. You know, I could ruin the acquisition. So we walk in, 1IL, Infinite Loop, get in the elevator, and I'm nervous as can be. And in the elevator is Bruce Sewell, the general counsel, and he goes, "Congratulations." And I said, "Okay, this is really happening. So now I really can screw this up. That's going to be a problem." So we get up, we get into the executive office, you know, in his conference room, and got the whole exec team, Tim Cook, Phil Schiller, Forrestal, everyone's sitting there, small talk, we're chatting. And then, you know, about half hour later, Steve walks in and it's just silence. And for about 3 hours, he grills us. And, you know, some of the most insightful questions, the most insightful questions. And I'm, you know, the thing that no one's talked about yet, but the thing about Steve that I notice is, there not only was there no small talk, there were these most awkward moments of silence. So he's asking questions and then just sitting there, kind of hand on his chin, pondering, thinking, and you're, you know, the natural thing is to jump in and talk. But just awkward silence. And this goes on for 3 hours, no chit chat. And at the very end, he goes, "You know, Steven, so you have a family?" And I said, "I do." I said, "I have a wife. I have a young kid. I have another one on the way." He goes, where are you from?" I said, "New Jersey." He goes, "My wife Lorraine's from New Jersey." She's like, "I like New Jersey." And that was like, you know, that the good thing is we got acquired, so I didn't screw it up. And now I'll set up the story for, you know, that I've told Chris a million times that I love. So anyway, he buys us. This is December 2009. We get instructions down from Steve. We have no idea what they're buying and why they're buying us. We just know that, you know, he wanted to do something. He wanted ads on the iPhone to be beautiful. He wanted them to be TV-like. He didn't want, as he said, shitty little ads, shitty little banner ads on his devices. And so, you know, it's January 2010. We get instruction that they're code freezing in like 3 weeks and we have to give them everything we need to build a product. We had no idea that they were even going to launch. So finally I get disclosed. We're launching this new product. And there's like three of us who know about it. I mean, it's a handful of people. And we get all his best, we get all the best people working for Steve. They know it's a tentpole thing. We're told that he's going to announce this new thing at WWDC in June, and he wants to work with the best brands in the world, and he wants us to go out and he wants to tell the developers that Apple is making them millions of dollars. And so 2010, the idea of mobile ads just didn't really even exist. And the idea of selling large mobile advertising deals in 2010, I mean, this is pre-Facebook, they were small deals. But Steve wanted us to sell million-dollar deals. And that was the first thing I heard was, you got to go sell $1 million deals. And I said, whew, I mean, no one's even sold $100,000 deals on mobile, let alone $1 million deals. But, you know, Steve asked, you do it. So I remember our first meeting, we're going on roadshow. In fact, Mike Owen, who's in the room, he was with me. And we're running around, we're talking to ad agencies. And the first agency we meet with, they literally laughed us out of the room. I mean, we're with a dev product didn't even exist. iAd, which was what it was called, didn't even exist. And we literally get laughed out of the room like, no one's giving you $1 million. And never forget, we then go, we meet, and we're like, you know, we're not going to waste time with agencies. We're just going directly to the clients. And we go to Citi, and Citi had been a partner with Apple. And they're like, I love this. This is beautiful. I mean, we created the most beautiful ad format that existed at that time in on the iPhone. It was a keynote deck. It hadn't even really existed. And needless to say, we got Citi to buy the first iAd. And I remember I came back, I told Andy, he was meeting with Steve weekly, we had a prep for the meeting. And Steve goes to Andy, he goes, I didn't say $1 million deal. We're not doing $1 million deals. We're doing $10 million deals. Tell them we're not taking it. Go back to Citi and tell them they need to spend $10 million or we're not taking it. So I'm like, oh my God, we just finally got someone who was willing to spend $1 million. And now I got to tell them that that's not good enough. They got to spend 10. So I did that. We did that. And needless to say, not only did we get them to spend 10 million, we got four other brands to spend 10 million. And we sold $60 million worth of ads in about 6 weeks. Off of a keynote deck.
Steven, you just weren't aiming high enough. That's the problem. I think you needed to get inspired. So I'm glad you did. But
yeah, that was that.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciate it. And it just shows how you can be aim higher, do better. I want to bring up a friend, Bill Reduschel, who I think worked on the AOL Warner Music deal with Apple, and maybe what also I know also worked at Sun, and many people don't know that at one point Sun almost bought Apple. Bill, maybe you could just tell one or two short stories and would love to hear them. If you're there, are you there? You're muted right now. Maybe I lost Bill. Maybe he's away.
No,
from
he's there, Bill.
I see him, but I don't know if he's listening.
Yeah, he's got to press his unmute button.
Yeah, you
got to
unmute yourself, Bill. I'm going to tell a story of mine. I've got about three Steve Jobs interactions. One of them was recorded on video from the All Things D conference. If you ever wanted to Google that, it's kind of a funny story with our company we invested in called Flurry. Another story that started with the first All Things D that I ever attended, and that's, Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg's original thing with the Wall Street Journal. Bill, we'll have you back in a second. Let me finish my story. I see you there now. But I was at I collect computers. I have them in my museum here at home, and I wanted to get Steve to sign my Apple II. I had already gotten Woz to sign it years earlier, and I took the little plastic cover off, and I had it in my little bag, and I was sitting in the front row when Steve was speaking, and I was watching where the green room was and where he was going to walk off, and as soon as he stopped and the applause happened, I jumped in behind the curtain and was waiting for him as he came down the stairs, and I just shook his hand, and I said, Steve, Chris Fralick, a big fan. I've sold your products for years, and I wondered if you'd sign my Apple II. And he looks at me and he goes, oh, I'm sorry. I don't sign things like that. And he looks down at my hands, and I'm holding the lid and my Sharpie, you know, magic marker. And he goes, oh, cool, Woz signed it. And he turned around and walked away. And he left me hanging there with my only Woz signed Apple II lid. But it's a good story, so I have that now. But anyway, Bill, you're now unmuted, and I'd love to hear some of your story.
I mean, I did all the due diligence for the acquisition. So I understood what all the issues were at Apple. As was noted earlier, they were in rough financial shape. And it was just the testimony to Steve's brilliance that he knew every single one of the fundamental problems and went right after them and knew how to fix them. And, you know, from outside, I could watch it and see it. But we'd had a lot of interaction at Next, because Next was not a great financial success. And we had been in conversation for a long time and finally decided that we would make a bid to buy Next. And I did the due diligence there. And Steve knew we were working on it. So I got invited to breakfast at his house on a Sunday morning. Now, I assure you, there was no other reason in the world for Steve to invite me to breakfast at his home on a Sunday morning. But he was trying everything in his power to get the number up. So I walk into the office at Next, and the receptionist says, Mr. Jobs is waiting for you in the boardroom. So people who were in the Next boardroom will remember that while it was a startup, the boardroom was not a startup. The boardroom was all mahogany furniture and beautiful and elegant, and the lights were off. There was only one light on. It was a spotlight in the ceiling above Steve. So he was lighted at the end of this table, but all the other lights in the room were off. And I walk in and I sit down and I try to do casual conversation to start. And he looks at me and he goes, what's the number? And I go, number? He says, yeah, how much are you willing to pay? I said, $283 million. He said, congratulations, Bill. That's the right number. If I was going to buy Next and I was some, that's what I would pay. I want $400 and walked out of the room. That was the conversation. He wanted 400, and he got it eventually from Gilamileo, because that's what he promised the guy who fell on his butt off the dining room table chair, because he promised him that he would get him his money back. And so at 400, Cannon was paid off, and that's what he wanted.
That's exactly right.
And I was in the room when we were negotiating. Paul Vittick was the signatory for Warner Music, and we were negotiating the first deal. And the big obstacle was that Steve didn't want copy protection. He wanted no copy protection. And, you know, Paul's explaining the benefits of copy protection. And it's like suddenly in the middle of this conversation, Steve realizes copy protection is going to be really good for me. And suddenly, you know, it was just instant to see the bit switch. And in fact, copy protection was added to the iPods for the purchased music. And but out of that came a contractual clause, because Apple wanted to have rights to put the music onto computers, and computers, you had the risk of piracy. So there was a clause in the agreement which said that you could only have 5 devices on which you had access to the user file system.
We're still living with that today, I think, Bill, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's why the iPhone is structured the way it is because in order for the iPhone to be an iPod, you can't have access to the user file system. So that's why it runs all of this in sandbox stuff and makes you exchange outside, is it all goes back to that contract provision, which nobody at the time thought of as anything other than a way to reduce the legal language, something that we'd agreed to do in business terms. So it teaches you that, you know, again, it's a sentence, but it ends up, you know, still driving the architecture of mobile devices today. But I did multiple deals with him, and he would always.
You're in the Isaacson book. You're in the bibliography.
And
there's more stories to be told. But
we'll move on.
We have. I'm gonna pick 15 minutes from now to wrap up. I want to get to a couple more folks that are up here on stage, but also ask my co-hosts to think about any other stories they've got and want to share. And but let me turn over to Buzz Wood, who he and I were selling Macintoshes together in the late 80s and early 90s. Buzz, you got to unmute if you're going
to. Yeah, I know. I was trying to get the right button, man. I had the same problem Bill had. Hey, thanks, Chris, for bringing me on. My one and only encounter with Steve was in around 2002. I was engaged to my wife, who was a senior marketing manager at Apple Education, and lived in Saratoga, right around the way from Infinite Loop. But anyway, Steve was going to address around 750, education sales reps and everything from around the country, and I was in the audience and kind of up front. And the way it worked is that Steve would come on this abbreviated stage. And then you would come up and say, "Hey, I'm Chris Fralick. I'm from Philly," and you know. And then your question. And so I had the nerve to get up because I had a question. So Steve showed up late, and the word was around the room he was pissed off. It was like he felt like he got bushwhacked, is what he said. And he got brought to this meeting, so he's not in the best of moods. Anyway, he gets up there, and so he starts taking questions. So I go up and I go, "Hi, I'm Buzz Wood. I'm from Florida." And he turns to his people, because I'm not too many feet from him, and he says, "If this guy's screwing with me, I'm going to fire him right now." And because he still owned Pixar at the time, and Buzz and Woody were the central characters. So here's a guy that rolls up and has got a name, Buzz Wood. What the heck is that? And so he goes, "All right, what's your question?" By that point, I wanted to kind of just crawl back to my seat and melt away or something. But anyhow, I ask my question, and he dismisses me. The next guy comes up and says, "Steve, I'm so glad to be here, and I'm such a fan." He goes, "All right, what's your question?" And the guy goes, "Well, I was wondering if we could run a commercial on about Apple computers in education." And he goes, "No, we're not going to do that." And so the guy goes, "Oh, okay." And so he starts walking away, and Steve goes, wait a minute, come back. And he says, "What did we pay you?" And he looks off stage and he goes, "All right, doesn't matter. I tell you what, I got a deal for you. I can run a 30-second ad. I'll fire you and use that money and run the ad. What do you think of that?" And the guy goes, Well, I don't know. And he goes, "I didn't think you did." He goes, "Go sit down." That was it. That's it was funny. Classic. That's classic. Funny.
Thanks, Buzz. Let me ask Esther or Steven, anything else you want to add? Because we've got two other speakers beyond that. But
I might have one at the very end, but maybe you can ask Ted Cohen to chime in with something.
Ted, welcome. Ted's a music industry legend, and I'm sure has a good Steve Jobs story.
So, all of you who knew him much better than I did will appreciate this. We came up to Cupertino to do the initial discussion before we negotiated for EMI Music. I was on the team, and it was me and a guy named John Rose, who had just joined us from McKinsey. And Claudio now at, I think, Bernstein, and a guy named Richard Cottrell, the four of us, and across from us in Steve's conference room was Dave Robin, who created the iTunes app, Eddie Q, Steve, and Bud Tribble. And they show a deck explaining what's happening with iTunes and how the store is going to work. And then Steve starts talking about who the ideal customer is. And John stands up and says, "Well, actually, I just came from working at McKinsey, where we did a study for Bertelsmann and Thomas Middleoff regarding taking Napster legal. And we have really up-to-date information. excuse me. And he goes up to the whiteboard, and there's 30 feet of whiteboard. And he starts writing, the ideal consumer is a 19-year-old male. I can't remember what it was, but he wrote something. Now there's 30 feet of whiteboard. Steve walks up, erases junk, and writes, no, actually, the ideal digital consumer is this. John then gets up and erases Steve's work. So within maybe a 1 foot area on a 30 feet of whiteboard, they proceeded literally for 30 minutes to erase each other's work. We then continued. We then started negotiating the deal, and Kevin Saul, who might have been on your team, Bill, I'm not sure, but Kevin Saul was the point person for legal, and I ended up being point for EMI. And I never knew where I stood in this whole thing, except one day, Alon Levy, who was the chairman of EMI, forwarded an email to me. And the email was from Alon to Steve, and it said, how did the deal negotiations go today? And he wrote back, terrible, Ted wasn't available. And I went, okay, he knows who I am. And
you've got that going for you, Ted, among many
other things. That was it. Thanks so much.
That's fantastic. Great, great to have you here. And I think Sanal, welcome. Would love to hear your story. Or
thanks, Chris. Thanks. I only have one story, and it's from when I was at Xerox PARC. And of course, there's like a really tortured legacy there. You could, even when I went, which is, you know, after all that passed, there was this sense of insecurity around the narrative and how it was told, and it was just a really interesting time. So anyway, we had started, we being Xerox PARC at the time, I still think of it as a we. We had started this big program called Content-Centric Networking, and it was led by Van Jacobson, who is really famous for putting the TCP into TCP/IP and really pioneering the MBone and the kind of multimedia side of the internet. And it was a really, really big, big, big idea, like one of the biggest initiatives we'd really gone down. NSF was funding us. Like, I felt so proud of this project. It was so many people work, and it was basically addressing the internet by name, not just arbitrary IP address. So a bunch of us decided to bring attention to this project to Steve Jobs, and we sent an email, not at all expecting him to like reply. It was like literally just like, let's look up and guess what his email address was. I don't even think anyone even had the latest convention. And we sent an email, not expecting any kind of reply, kind of selling the idea to him to think, to see and hear what he would say and if he would respond and if he'd want to be part of a consortium that we were putting together. And like within minutes, he replied. And I didn't see the message of the next day, though. And he basically said in just one line, sounds like a technology solution looking for a problem. And it, excuse my language, fucking blew my mind. Because he saw it in a way that nobody else had. And this is like 20 of the best scientists in the world, literally, on the topic, and everybody else. And it just really stuck with me to this day. And in fact, literally 2 days later, when I had the offer to leave PARC to go to Wired, I jumped, because it kind of made me realize, oh my God, what if you're working on the wrong things? And I just think that blows my mind how he saw the essence of that within like a second, which is incredible. Just one line email. That was my story with Steve Jobs.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And I want to, I guess, thank everybody for being here. And it's been incredible. There's now, I think, 3,300 people in the room. So there's clearly a lot more stories that we're not getting to. And I would encourage anyone to, you know, shoot us a note on Twitter or email if you know that, or, you know, just to tell us if there's a story you've got, and maybe we'll do another one or do it in a different way, but love any feedback that you have. And I guess, you know, particularly thank people like Regis and John and Andy and Bill, like, for coming spending your time. And thanks to Esther and Stephen, but I'll turn it over to you two to bring us home.
Yeah, I just want to add two things. They aren't stories really, but you know, I'm old enough to get a COVID vaccine, and I've seen a couple of amazing things in my life, and I just want to mention two of them, both of which involved Steve. One was when he announced the next, it was in the afternoon, it was in the San Francisco Opera or something, and there's no one else in the industry where you would go on a date to watch them announce their product. But that is what I did. And the second is kudos to Kara Swisher at the All Things D conference. One of Steve's very last public appearances was Kara interviewing him and Bill Gates together. And it was amazing. It was heartrending. It was the entire industry encapsulated. I'm sure it's up there online somewhere. And if you really want to get a feeling for the two of them, it's just a magical thing. And I was so excited to be there personally. I don't know if you were there too, Stephen.
Yeah, I was. And actually, I almost ended it before it happened because I had done this interview with Bill Gates for Newsweek about Vista. And I triggered him and he started like, asked him about the John Hodgman commercial with the back and he just went into a rant about how Steve is lying about, you know, what the PC is like. And then when I got to Steve, he said, you know, to Walt, he said, you know, I can't do this with this guy. And, you know, Walt had to talk him down off the wall. But I want to thank everyone as well, Chris, for first organizing it, Esther for co-hosting, especially the people who came up and talked. You know, I'm sure I could sit down with Andy and Bill and we could talk for like 2 hours because both of them have such amazing stories. Susan Kierner couldn't come up, but, and Daniel and you know, can I cherish the friendship I have those people, as I mentioned before. I guess the final story I'll tell is the last time I talked to Steve, it was coming on almost 10 years right now. Like, and Steve was very sick. And though Tim Cook later told me that he always thought until the very end that Steve would make it, you know, there was this consciousness that, you know, that he would meet people and it was, you know, maybe the last time we talk. And John Markoff, a fellow journalist, and I were talking about this, and we felt we wanted to just touch base with him one more time, or at least have a conversation with him. And John wrote him and said, hey, Stephen Levy's in town. We thought we'd just get together, like no agenda, right? And Steve wrote back within like an hour and said, well, we'll come to Apple tomorrow morning, you know, 10 a.m. We went to Infinite Loop, you know, place both of us have been to a lot. And, you know, we see Steve driven up. You know, he wasn't driving. And, and people were surprised to see him. He wasn't really coming in that often. And we went up to the suite of offices he had on the fourth floor, One Infinite Loop. And we sat and just talked for an hour and a half about anything, about the future, about, you know, about the past, about things we knew. And, you know, and what struck me was it's the middle of a business day. And technically, I think, you know, I mean, he was still the chair or whatever, you know, Tim had all the duties, but like there was like not one phone call or interruption. We just like went and talked and we had a fantastic talk. And unfortunately, he at the end, you know, he said, you know, we should get together with all the people from the Mac team, you know, and get together. And John and I thought, you know, it wasn't appropriate for us to be there. Steve really should have that reunion with the Mac team. We passed it on to some of the people there. And, you know, Andy, I don't know if you recall that, but I don't think that reunion ever happened, did it?
If you mean Andy Cunningham, yes, it did happen.
Oh, it did?
Yes, it did. Did you get together? Well, it was very nice. Steve unfortunately could not make it. He was feeling too ill, but he called in. And we did it at Joanna's house.
Oh, okay. All right. Great. I'm happy. I knew he didn't make it there, and I didn't make it. And
no, Stephen, yeah. John did. John did, and he took notes and recorded it too.
Yeah. That's great. That's right. I remember he was telling me about it, but it's a shame that Steve didn't get there. But anyway, it was just, you know, hanging over, you know, that conversation was the idea that this is probably our last substantive conversation, and we all miss him so much, you know. And it's great to be with all of you.